All right, so we're diving into an alimony case out of North Carolina that should have every lawyer out there double-checking their court filings. Gilmartin v. Gilmartin. And let me tell you, this is a case where the husband's appeal backfired big time. And the reason why is really interesting. It all boils down to what wasn't in the court record.
Yeah, you know, it's fascinating how these seemingly small procedural things can have such a huge impact on a case, especially when we're talking about appeals.
Exactly. So we've got the actual court opinions for this one, plus what we're calling a podcast guidance memo. Clearly, someone wrote this up after the fact, probably for other lawyers, to break down what happened. It's like we get to peek behind the scenes and see how the legal pros analyze, well, let's just say a learning experience.
A learning experience for sure, and this one is all about the incomplete record doctrine, which is, you know, not just some technicality, it's a core principle of appeals.
Okay, so listeners, whether you're a seasoned attorney or just starting out, you're going to want to pay attention to this one.
Oh, absolutely. This case is just packed with insights about strategy, evidence, and those little gotcha moments that can completely change the outcome of a case.
All right, so walk me through this Gilmartin story. What happened?
Oh, we've got a couple married from 2006 to 2016, one child. The marriage ends in divorce, and the wife is awarded alimony, $1,100 a month for 48 months. Sounds pretty typical so far, right?
Yeah, seems like it. So where does it all go off the rails?
Well, the husband, he decides to appeal the alimony award. Seems reasonable enough, but here's the catch. His appeal is based on a transcript that's missing a crucial part of the whole trial.
Wait a minute, missing? You mean like they just didn't record that part of the trial?
Not exactly, no. So the trial covered two main things, right? The division of assets, what we call equitable distribution, and then the alimony issue. But the husband's attorney, get this, only submitted the transcript from the alimony part, the entire section about how they split their property, completely missing from the appeal record.
Oh, wow. I mean, that's a pretty big mistake. Didn't anybody, I don't know, notice that this was missing before they filed the appeal?
You would think, right? But that's exactly what happened. And this is where that incomplete record doctrine comes in. It's huge in appeals courts.
So break it down for me. Why is this doctrine such a big deal?
Well, think of it like this. Appellate courts, they have to work within some pretty strict rules. They can only review what's given to them in the official record. They can't just fill in the blanks or, you know, guess about what went down at the trial.
Got it. So in this situation, because the appeal didn't have the whole transcript, particularly the financial stuff, the appeals court basically said, look, we can't decide if the alimony award was fair or not because we don't have all the financial details.
Exactly. They had no choice but to assume that the trial court got it right, since they didn't have all the pieces to really assess the husband's arguments. Talk about shooting yourself in the foot.
Ouch. Yeah. This is a good reminder. Even if you think you have a slam dunk case for an appeal, a procedural mistake can just totally tank your case. What a lesson for lawyers.
It really is. Meticulous record keeping, it's not just a suggestion, it is essential. Mistakes like this can have some seriously bad consequences for your clients.
Now let's talk about what actually happened in this marriage. You said the husband's behavior played a role in the alimony award, right? What was going on there?
Right. So the wife, she alleged things like pornography addiction, you know, solicitations online and affairs. Her argument was that all this was marital misconduct under North Carolina law.
Well, okay. He doesn't sound like husband of the year.
Yeah.
But how does North Carolina law deal with this kind of behavior? Does watching porn mean you automatically get denied alimony?
No, it's actually a bit more complicated than that. North Carolina law actually makes a distinction between indignities and then illicit sexual behavior.
Indignities. Honestly, I haven't heard that word used outside of like a history book. What does that even mean in this context?
It's a key difference in these types of cases, actually. Indignities refers to a pattern of behavior that creates a hostile or harmful environment for the marriage, like ongoing emotional abuse or humiliation, controlling behavior, things that really chip away at the foundation of the relationship.
Oh, okay. So it's not just about one specific act. It's about the overall effect of the behavior and how much emotional damage it caused.
Precisely. Adultery, that's obviously serious, but it's dealt with under that illicit sexual behavior category. In the Gilmartin case, the court really zeroed in on the indignity side of things. They found that his behavior was a persistent pattern that really hurt the marriage, you know, above and beyond any isolated instances of adultery.
So the specifics matter. The exact type of misconduct can really change the whole outcome.
Absolutely. And for anyone dealing with a fault-based divorce, understanding these nuances is crucial.
Now, did the husband try to argue that his wife had, forgiven him for all of this?
He did. He brought up this defense called condonation, which is basically saying, yeah, I messed up, but my spouse, she forgave me, and we kept going with the marriage, so it shouldn't be held against me now.
I mean, that seems like a tough argument to make given the circumstances. How did that play out?
Well, condonation, it's not as simple as just saying, I forgive you. Legally, you have to show clear evidence that the spouse who was wronged knew about what happened and then chose to stay in the marriage anyway, knowing full well what was going on.
So it's not just forgiveness, it's about knowingly accepting the behavior and making a conscious choice to move forward with the marriage anyway. That's a high bar.
Exactly. And in this case, the court didn't buy it. The wife, she had confronted him several times trying to get him to change his behavior. That showed the court that she never really condoned what he was doing. She may have tried to make things work, but she never truly accepted his misconduct.
So even though they stayed together after all this, her actions were more convincing than his words. It's a good reminder that keeping records of everything is so important, especially in these types of cases where you have to prove a pattern of behavior or, like here, a lack of acceptance.
Absolutely. Every single action, every conversation, it can all become critical evidence.
Okay, so we've got this incomplete record that sank the appeal, and then the condemnation defense didn't work either. But before we move on, I'm curious, what about the other judges on the panel? Sometimes, even when judges agree on the outcome, they write their own separate opinions to highlight specific points, right? Did that happen here?
You're right, and we do actually have two concurring opinions in this case that are worth looking at. Even though they agreed that the alimony award should stand, both judges used this case to really emphasize how important that complete record is.
So what do they have to say?
Judge Dillon, in his concurrence, he really hammered home this idea of fairness in the process. He said that without a complete record, the appellate court is basically flying blind, right? They can't properly evaluate the case or make sure that justice is being served.
Yeah, it's like trying to, I don't know, build a house without having the blueprints.
Yeah.
You might end up with something that looks like a house, but is it actually safe? You just don't know.
Exactly. And Judge Berger, in his concurrence, he connected this back to the idea of, public trust in the courts. He argued that these kinds of oversights can actually erode people's faith in the legal system because it makes you wonder if the decisions are really fair and impartial.
That's a really good point. So even though this appeal was, probably doomed from the start because of that incomplete record, those concurring opinions really bring up a much bigger issue, right? They're a reminder that procedural rules, they're not just technicalities, they're there to guarantee a fair process for everyone involved.
Absolutely. And this whole case, it's a cautionary tale for all the lawyers out there. Get those details right, folks.
Okay, so we've talked about the procedural stuff, but let's dig into the husband's behavior itself. The pornography addiction, the online solicitations, the affairs. This raises some really interesting questions about how courts are dealing with marital misconduct, especially in our digital age.
Yeah, you're right. This case really shows how much relationships have changed and how those changes are playing out in the legal world.
I mean, even 10 years ago, this kind of online behavior wasn't as common, right? And now it seems like everyone's trying to figure out where the boundaries are, both personally and legally.
Definitely. And the courts focus on the indignities part of what the husband did, the ongoing emotional harm instead of just focusing on the physical adultery. That's significant, I think.
Yeah, I see what you mean. It suggests that our thinking about marital misconduct might be changing. It's not just about physical cheating anymore. It's about recognizing how damaging these behaviors can be emotionally.
Exactly. It's like the court was saying, look, even if there wasn't physical cheating every time, this whole pattern of deception and online activity, it created a toxic environment and caused real harm to the marriage.
So, are you saying that just looking at pornography or having online chats, could that be seen as marital misconduct, even if it doesn't turn into a physical affair?
I wouldn't say it's that black and white. It really depends on the specifics of each case. But the Gilmartin case definitely brings up some interesting questions about where we draw the line. What does emotional harm look like in a digital world? When does harmless online activity cross over into something that undermines the whole marriage?
Those are tough questions, and I don't think there are easy answers. But it's a conversation we need to have, especially as technology becomes even more intertwined with relationships.
Absolutely. And this case, it could be the starting point for those conversations in legal circles and in society as a whole.
Okay, so we've got the procedural issues, the changing definitions of marital misconduct, and all the tricky questions around digital infidelity. But we should talk more about condonation too, right?
To a point. This case is a perfect example of how tricky that defense can be. It's not enough to just say, oh, there was forgiveness. You have to prove it.
So if someone wants to use condonation as a defense, what are the key things they would need to show?
Well, the first thing is you have to prove that the spouse who was wronged knew about the misconduct. No pretending it didn't happen or looking the other way. And then you have to show that they made a clear decision to stay in the marriage after they knew, like a real attempt at reconciliation, you know, a genuine effort to move forward.
Right. So it's more than just living together. It's about truly accepting what happened, both emotionally and mentally.
Exactly. And the husband in this case, he couldn't prove that. The wife's actions, her trying to get him to change, all that contradicted his argument that she had just forgiven and moved on. It shows that what you do matters more than what you say, especially in court.
So anyone thinking about using the condemnation defense, be ready to back it up with solid evidence. Just saying, oh, they forgave me, that's not going to fly. You need to show a real pattern of reconciliation and acceptance.
Definitely. And keep records, you know, notes, emails, therapy records, anything that helps prove that the spouse who was hurt actually chose to stay in the marriage after knowing about the misconduct.
That's good advice. Okay, we've covered a lot here. Procedural mistakes, how the definition of marital misconduct is changing, and all the intricacies of condonation. But before we move on, I want to talk about something else. The human element of all this.
Yes. It's easy to get caught up in the legal arguments and forget that these cases involve real people, real relationships, and real pain.
Right. We have a husband whose actions cause real damage, a wife who tried to save the marriage but couldn't in the end, and then a child caught in the middle. It makes you realize that even though courts deal with laws and rules, these cases affect people's lives in a big way.
That's such an important point. We've been analyzing this from a legal angle. But it's crucial to remember that there are people at the heart of it all. And divorce can be really, really difficult emotionally, especially when there are accusations of misconduct involved.
Absolutely. And even though the court's decision might provide some legal closure, the emotional scars can take a lot longer to heal.
Very true. And sometimes the most important takeaways from these cases aren't about legal strategy or procedures. They're about empathy, about compassion, and about how complicated human relationships can be.
Well said. This case has definitely given us all a lot to think about. But before we wrap up this part of our deep dive, I'm curious to get your take on the bigger implications of Gilmartin v. Gilmartin. So we've looked at this case from all these different angles, the procedural missteps, how the definition of marital misconduct is evolving, and the real human impact of these legal battles. As we wrap up our deep dive into Gilmartin v. Gilmartin, what kind of lasting impact do you think this case might have? Does it set any kind of precedent? And what could it mean for divorce cases moving forward?
Well, it's important to remember that each case is unique. You know, they're decided on their own specific facts. But Gilmartin does offer some valuable insights that could influence future cases, especially those dealing with similar issues.
Like what kind of insights? Can you give me some specifics?
For one, the way the court focused on indignities as a type of marital misconduct, it could indicate a shift in how courts are approaching emotional harm within marriage.
So it's not just about catching someone in a lie or proving infidelity. It's about recognizing that some behaviors, even if they don't fit into those traditional categories, can still have a huge impact over time.
Right. It suggests that courts are starting to recognize that emotional abuse, manipulation, and deceit can be just as damaging as physical betrayal. And in this case, it seems like the court is saying, hey, those forms of harm need to be considered when we're talking about things like alimony.
That's a big deal.
Yeah.
Makes me wonder, could this shift in thinking impact other areas of law too? Not just divorce cases. Like, what about workplace harassment claims?
It's definitely possible. Imagine a situation where an employee is constantly dealing with, like, belittling comments, microaggressions, emotional manipulation from their boss. In the past, it might have been hard to build a legal case around that kind of behavior. But now, someone could point to Gilmartin as precedent and argue that those actions create a hostile work environment, that they cause real damage, even if there wasn't any physical or sexual harassment.
That's a really interesting point. It seems like this case could lead to a deeper understanding of what harm really means in different legal situations, especially now with technology blurring the lines between our personal and professional lives.
Absolutely. We live in a world where so much of how we communicate and interact is happening online, and the law is still trying to figure out what all that means.
Speaking of online behavior, we can't ignore the whole digital infidelity issue. Do you think Gilmartin sets any kind of precedent for how courts might handle these things in the future? Could things like watching porn or having online chats be enough to be considered marital misconduct, even if there's no physical affair?
It's hard to say for sure, but the fact that the court emphasized the husband's pattern of deception and the harm it caused, that could be significant. It might mean that judges are more willing to look beyond just physical infidelity and consider the whole picture of what's happening online.
So it's not just about what someone does online, but why they're doing it and how it's affecting the relationship.
Right. And I think that's where things get really complicated, because how do you define harm when it comes to digital interactions?
Yeah.
Where is the line between what's okay and what's not? These are questions that courts will have to keep wrestling with as technology changes and our ideas about relationships change too.
It's a whole new world out there.
Yeah.
And the law is still playing catch up. But Gilmartin gives us some clues about how things might develop, and it definitely raises some big questions that we all need to be thinking about.
I agree. And beyond the specific legal questions, this case really underlines something we've been talking about throughout our discussion, how important it is to document everything.
Be prepared. Right.
Exactly. Whether it's evidence of marital misconduct, proof of condemnation, or just having a complete record for an appeal, having the right documentation can make all the difference in a case. And that's even more true now with so much of our lives happening online.
It reminds us that what we do online leaves a trace. And those things we think are private can have real-world consequences.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
Well, I think that brings us to the end of our deep dive into Gilmartin v. Gilmartin. This case has taken us on quite a journey through procedural traps, changing social norms, and the complexities of human relationships in our digital world.
It's been fascinating, hasn't it? I hope our listeners found it informative and got them thinking.
For anyone who wants to dig deeper into these issues, we encourage you to check out the full court opinions, read legal commentary, and keep the conversation going about the future of family law. Because, as Gilmartin shows us, even a seemingly simple alimony case can open up a much bigger conversation about how we live, love, and connect in a world that's getting more and more complex.
And who knows? Maybe this case will inspire some of you listening to become the legal minds who shape these conversations and help us figure out all these new challenges around law and technology in the years to come.